The teachings of General Conference are the considerations the Lord would have before us now and in the months ahead.
Our marching orders for each 6 months are found in the General Conference addresses.
For the next 6 months, your conference edition of the Ensign should stand next to your standard works and be referred to frequently.
I encourage you to read the talks once again and to ponder the messages contained therein.
I exhort you to study the messages of this conference frequently, even repeatedly, during the next 6 months.
You're listening to the Conference Talk Podcast, where it's conference weekend every weekend. Each weekend on this show, we discuss talks from the most recent General Conference of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. We'll share some insights, make some connections, and hopefully have a little bit of fun as we discuss the words of the awesome men and women God has called to direct this church in these latter days. I'm Matthew Watkins, and I'm joined by a very special guest this week. This is Ben Pacini. Now, you may know him from, if you've been following him, he's pretty active on Twitter. He also runs a really great podcast, posts not nearly as frequently as I would like, called Radical Civility. And he's also a contributor to Public Square, and his most recent article in Public Square was recently picked up by the Real Clear Religion Foundation, which is a subset, you told me, of Real Clear Politics, and got some fairly good traction. And you work a lot in the education sphere. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I was actually a math teacher. So I was in
the most hated.
The most hated, but that's
the most hated subject.
Right?
Sorry,
the most hated. No. The math faculty, like, trust me, teachers aren't any better than the subject matter. But you know, I was a middle school math teacher for 6 years in Baltimore City, and it was an absolute blast. And then I became an administrator in DC, and education is what I do. It's my favorite stuff, and I absolutely love it. And then came out here. I'm at BYU Idaho now. I teach future teachers, but I love the gospel. General Conference is my thing. Like, it's my, when I was dating my wife, I asked her, like, you know, are you into sports? And I was really worried she would say yes. And she was like, no, not really. And I was like, oh, good. Yes. Right. And she goes, is that okay? And I was like, it's fantastic. She said, oh, good. I didn't want to have to worry about, like, Super Bowl parties. I was like, I should mention there is this thing every 6 months that I do where it will be worse than a Super Bowl party. And that was General Conference. So yeah, this is my stuff. I love it. I actually feel bad because I 100% was guilty of lots of prognostication and predictions. And it's still something, it's one of my sins that I still need to give up. Let's just say it that way. But I actually really enjoy the.
I don't know that it's a sin. It's kind of like, people like to rag on gospel theories too. Like, oh yeah, you should just stick to what's said in the standard works. You shouldn't have any other ideas. I'm like, you know, I think theories are good as long as you don't elevate them to the point of doctrine. Like, if you're very
hashtag make Mormonism weird again, right? Like, you know, like that's my favorite stuff.
Yeah, you can have your theories, just don't teach it in gospel doctrine class, and don't, you know, say that it's, like, you know, endorsed by the church or anything. Because, yeah, this is how I think the atonement works. Okay, sure.
Well, and at the end of the day, one of the things, you know, I wrote a little post about this for FAIR that I now post on my Facebook wall every year. And basically what it said was, it's about intent. If your goal is to turn conference into a hobby, I think that can get dangerous. If your goal is to, you know, harden your heart against a certain speaker, if it's like, oh, somebody's going to say something stupid. Yeah.
Here comes Oaks again.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Like, that's not a good spirit, and you're going to get exactly what you expect to get. On the other hand, if you do it in a faithful way and hopefully a good-hearted and lighthearted way, I think there can be a real benefit to that. And that's what I've always tried to do, right? And it's been really rewarding because of that. So yeah, General Conference is great.
Yeah. And I love General Conference. And we were so excited to get you on as a guest for this particular talk. We are covering President Nelson's talk, Peacemakers Needed. And immediately you get the talk, I said, I want to get Ben Pacini on as the guest for this.
I feel like I'm cheating though. Like I get the best talk. And like, normally people are like, hey, you shouldn't have favorites. No, it's the prophet. Like, I think I win here. Like, this is amazing, right? Like, this is fantastic. And at the same time, like, so what I remember when I was younger, my dad just mentioned something to me. I mean, maybe it was I have a memory of a memory. So, you know, maybe it didn't happen quite this way, but it was something along the lines of one sign that you can tell whether you're in touch, is see what is said in conference and by the general leaders of the church and see if you're syncing up with that. See the extent to which they're talking about the same things that you are and that they're talking about them in the same way that you are. And civility has been on my mind since probably at least 2015. It's just been like, we have obligations that are different. And it started as a very personal thing. I'm not actually that civil. I don't like to be nice. Like somebody on Twitter was like, it just feels like you're being really inauthentic. Like, I can tell you want to say mean things. I was like, of course I want to say mean things. That's what's like,
it's called. Yes, self-control, dude.
Yes. Like, what are you talking about? Of course I want to say mean things. I'm
it's
not.
Like, cool. You recognize my efforts. Thank you.
Yes, exactly. Like, you think I'm just wimpy all the time? Like, I'm sorry. Like, and I am probably, but like, no, that's exactly what this is about, right? It's about me saying, I don't want to say mean things. I don't want to become that person. And when I see myself becoming that person, I try to stay away. So this was validating to me personally. Now, on the other side of that, I need to be really careful. You know, I saw a number of people as soon as this talk came out say, well, what the prophet really said was, and it's like, if you're hitting the asterisk key, the first thing when you hear a prophet talk, or the I was right all along key, like, I think both of those are a really worrisome thing where it's like, how about you let it hit you full force for a minute first? And the first thought that I had was like, before you do a victory lap, before you spike the ball, maybe you need to grapple a little bit with like, okay, but what can you do to be a little bit better? Because as much as I do care about civility, I'm not perfect. I do spike the ball. I do get grumpy. I, you know, whatever else it is. And I think I want to get into some of what that means for me and what I can change and how I can do better.
And have grace for people who did struggle with it where you have a strength. We've seen this a lot in the past just decade where the church has taken positions or made statements that kind of cut against the narrative of both political sides of the aisle, right? And so you have people upset by different partnerships they make with different organizations, or people upset by their vaccine mandates and upset, of course, by the LGBTQ stuff. And it's kind of like at this point, from a political perspective, not a doctrinal perspective, but from a political perspective, the church is an equal opportunity offender in a sense, right? I've seen offense taken on both sides of the political aisle. And what that reminds me of is, have a little grace, right? If I'm struggling with the church's stance on vaccination or on LGBTQ or on any of these issues, right? And of course, I'm not saying these are equivalent or the same magnitude, but if I'm having a struggle and it's like biting at me, I can have a little bit of grace for people who are having the struggles on the opposite end of the spectrum as well. Doesn't mean I have to agree with them or validate their opinions, but I can say, you know what? Yeah, you know, there are things that the Lord asks us to give up.
Yeah. Well, and I think you're spot on. And I would just add this. I don't really know what it means to be good faith, right? Like, because this is something you can abuse and you can just call somebody bad faith and weaponize it and be like, I don't think you're good faith. And what you really mean is I don't want to argue with you because you're making good points.
I'm jumping from what you're saying to who you are. Yeah. I'm going straight from your argument to your personhood.
It can absolutely be used to dismiss people. And that's really dangerous. On the other hand, I'm pretty open to talking with anyone if they're trying. And I don't think that means I get it right. In fact, part of the reason why I felt like I needed to get on Twitter is because I saw like it's dominated by the extreme polls. And I wanted just a normal guy who gets it wrong all the time, who makes mistakes, to be out there saying like, hey, I'm here to make jokes, have spicy education policy takes, some occasional memes, and to talk about the gospel occasionally. I want this to be a more normal conversation. I think that's been a good thing. But as you say, like in education, we talk a lot about an error-rich environment is the best way to learn. You actually need to be showing grace and making mistakes and learning from your mistakes. This isn't cheap grace. The test still matters, right? You don't go into the test and be like, it'll be fine if I make a bunch of mistakes. But I think it is a really important part of how we grow and how we learn is to give grace. And I think that's a lot of what was in this talk too.
And so you jump on Twitter where no grace is ever given.
Well, it's almost a competition. My friend Dan Ellsworth calls it the epistemology of hell. This is a very Dan Ellsworth phrase, and I love it. This is how he thinks. But the epistemology of hell is how do demons think? They think in accusation. They think in terms of what can I make you think you have done? How can I make you feel absolutely the worst about yourself? And that doesn't mean that there isn't sometimes a time to step in and say, no, this was wrong. This was not okay. I totally feel that. But right now, what we are doing is we're falling all over ourselves to win the accusation contest because we know that it scores this rhetorical and political point.
The accusation is never geared towards correction. It's geared towards, I'm right, you're wrong, and you're irredeemably wrong, by the way.
Yeah. Well, and you can tell because when people say, oh, yeah, I think I am wrong, they go, no, sorry, that stink don't wash off. You're stuck with that forever. Mm.
And you can't be hired anywhere.
Yeah. That's right. And because what it... And that to me is the difference. If I have a friend right now who's saying something online that I think is both wrong and damaging, this is a good reminder. I need to reach out to him. And I honestly, I was tempted to respond back publicly, and I was like, no, because I'm not trying to embarrass him. I'm going to send him a private email and say, hey, just so you know, the data on what you are saying is wrong, and I trust you, and I think you are thoughtful. I think you should look at this from this perspective. Even if we disagree, I just want you to know, like, this is my perspective and where I'm coming from. It's not about embarrassing him. I'm not trying to tear him down. I'm not even trying to get into a fight with him. And I think that's a good way for us to go.
If thy brother hath aught against thee, take him aside privately, right? And work it out there. You don't public shame. Yeah.
There's a book that I love, and it's a little bit more secular. But I think I would recommend it to anybody. I mean, I've got a whole list of books on civility and how to interact and dialogue. So Three Languages of Politics is great. And you know, Civility Rules by Forney is great. But there's a specific book that I think was not intended to be about social media at all, but really nails it. And it's called Grandstanding. And it's basically this entire, the whole point of the book is that we all do this without even realizing it, and that we all set ourselves up to make the other person look bad. And in fact, I'll look up the information and send it to you so we can put it in show notes. It's a very simple read. It's very quick, and it's a very easy way of understanding why Twitter is so broken, because it's not actually about you saying, hey, I just have this opinion. It's about me saying, I should be viewed as a good person because I have this opinion and all of you are bad people. It's all about this moral hierarchy climbing, and it gets really wonky. And you take a lot of wind out of people's sails when you just say, well, yeah, I might get it wrong. I'm just trying. And it's just not a big deal.
That's not going to get you any follows.
Yeah. No. And frankly, like, that's the best part about being on Twitter for me. Is like, I don't care. You know, like, it's not real life. When I have a bad day on Twitter, I go and, you know, kiss my wife and hug my kids and we play video games, and it doesn't matter. But, I really do think that once you realize, Elder Bednar said this a couple years ago, maybe it was just last year, there is an absolute emptiness to the great and spacious building, right? Like, it's just so bizarrely empty. When you really look under the surface of what's being discussed, and I'm not trying to say the people on Twitter are bad people or empty. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying most people know that Twitter is not or should not be real life. There are also people who get threatened with losing their job. And that's something that we can talk about too. But
speaking of workplace problems, President Nelson got a knife thrown at him at work. What did you think of that story? My goodness.
Here's the great thing about prophets, right? They don't foretell, they forthtell. My kids today, we were talking about what is a prophet? And they were saying, well, it's the head of the church. And I said, yeah, it is, but there are 15. There's not just one prophet. So what do they all do in common? And they said, ooh, do they all speak for Heavenly Father? I said, well, your elders, quorum, president can do that. So what is it that a prophet does that other people don't? And basically what we came up with is they tell us to repent and you really, really should listen.
Their words just carry extra weight?
I think that's a lot of it, right? Like, we will be held to account for what our apostles and prophets tell us. I love in 3 Nephi, Jesus comes and says, no. They're going to be judged by those 12 apostles, and you all will be judged by these 12 apostles. Like, it's a very literal accountability in a moral sense. I think that what this did was, it was so crystal clear. This story of the gangrene and the infection was so crystal clear, because he was saying, you don't have a right to let your anger run away from you, right? Like, you just, that is not an acceptable thing. And everybody went, yeah, of course, that's absurd. And then we go, oh, crap, he's talking to us. Like, he's not talking to them. He's saying me. Like, I don't get to be angry. Anger is the problem. I recently heard, The Dalai Lama was once asked if you could go back in time and, you know, I can't remember what it was, you know, hurt baby Hitler or some weird, you know, hypothetical question. Through the translators, he said, yes, I would, but I wouldn't allow myself to feel any hate or anger. And I feel like that's actually quite, there's something that you can learn from that there's a poison that comes into your heart when you allow yourself to be run by that kind of.
And he clarifies, you know, when he's talking about contention, he says, I'm not talking about peace at any price. Because I've seen, and I see this kind of creeping into the church a little bit right now. I know that Greg on his show talks a lot about the spiral of silence, where we just want to say, okay, well, let's just withdraw from the public square. Let's just withdraw from discussion. Let's not defend moral beliefs, because anytime we do that, we're going to get pushback and it's going to necessarily be contentious. And so let's just pull a circle of wagons. Let's just not get involved. And I know a lot of people who feel that way. And I wrote a post about this 5 years ago, no, 6 years ago, that became very relevant when we watched General Conference. And I said, I think there's a way to contend without the spirit of contention. Going back to your quote about the Dalai Lama, you read in the Doctrine and Covenants, it says to contend against false ideologies, to raise your voice and contend for the truth. You know, the Lord is very careful in how he says things. When Jesus speaks in 3 Nephi, he always talks about the spirit of contention is of the devil, the spirit of contention. I think that goes back to what you're saying. Like, you can stand up for truth. You can say things. You can disagree, even firmly, even boldly, without being a jerk, without trying to stir the pot and trying to upset people.
Well, and I would argue what most prophets have done, and when you read the scriptures, they're not out for popularity contests, right? And so if the goal is to make everybody happy, that's just not the job. Now, and this is something where, I have felt lately, I play it too safe sometimes. And here's how I'm trying to differentiate right now is if I'm playing it safe because I care about the other person and I want them to feel like they are being treated with love and kindness, I don't think that's wrong. If I'm doing it because I don't want to look bad, that's mm-hmm. a much more selfish concern, right? And so I think that you're exactly right. When President Nelson talks about peace at any cost, now I would also argue, sometimes students will ask me about testimony issues and in my office. And one of the things that I've started, I think
wait, is from math class. Oh, that's right.
No, it's because I do education, but I mean, even
that's
still,
right, yeah.
My office, I hope, is a place at BYU Idaho. I want any student to feel like they can come to me with anything, right? Whether it's a roommate issue or a testimony or whatever. And one of the things I've started telling them is, look, you know, as well as I do the primary answers, here's one that you won't hear, but I think is really important. You got to stand up for something, you know, that's true. And it's gotta be costly. It's gotta affect you just a little bit because
that
testimony. It's and once it does, so one of my articles went a little bit viral. I mean, one of my first ones, it was about LGBTQ stuff. And a buddy of mine reached out to me and said, how's it feel? And I said, well, you know, not great. I mean, people are really mad at me. He said, yeah, but like, how does it feel? I said, I don't know what you're talking about. He said, well, call me back in 2 weeks. So I called him back in 2 weeks. He said, now how does it feel? I said, I totally know what you're talking about. I feel free. He said, right? I said, where does this come from? He said, well, once you've taken the hit, you're not scared to stand up for what you know to be true anymore. You've already faced it, right? It's like a cold shower. You realize, like, I've been through that, and I feel comfortable standing up. I try to do it in kind ways and deliberate ways. And in fact, my article made people mad, I think, because it was very much geared towards, you must be kind, you must be inclusive, and in no way does that detract from you standing up for what you believe. And there's a false dichotomy that's been posed on this a lot, where it's like, you've got to choose one or the other. You can be loving and kind and accepting, or you can be a member of the church, and you can't do both, sorry. And it's like, no, I'm sorry, I have never in my life had to choose between being a disciple of Christ on the one hand or being a disciple of Christ on the other. And I think that's a message that we can hear a little bit.
I was watching an interview with Dallas Jenkins on The Chosen. I know this sounds tangential, it's not. But he talks about how in Christendom, the various Christological models, like, do you really emphasize Christ's divinity or do you really emphasize his humanity? And I mean, I'll be the first one to say the videos the church puts out heavily emphasize the divinity, almost to the point that he seems like not really someone you can connect with. Mm-hmm. And something that he's done with The Chosen, he says, look, it's not that we have to balance Christ's humanity with his divinity. He was fully divine and fully human. Yeah. Those aren't competing aspects of his nature. It's not like one comes at the expense of each other, but from our mortal frames, it's just hard to articulate that sometimes. Yeah. I feel like it's the same thing with these kind of discussions. We say, well, you can either, in fact, I even saw this on my kid's library. Painted on the wall, there was a mural, and it said something like, if you have to choose between being right and being kind, choose to be kind. I'm like, it's never kind to be wrong.
right. Like, this is, like, talk about a false dichotomy, right? Now, we should say there are a lot of jerks out there, and yes, they are really excited to focus on being right. A, they're not always right. A lot of the time, they're wrong. And B, they're just fighty, right? Like, they just want to pick fights all day.
Well, you know, they're such jerks. I've been one of those many times.
Look, and I think that's important. Now, maybe another time we'll get into how I think the world needs disagreeable people who will stand up and say, no, y'all are wrong, right? Like, I think there's actually a social utility to that. We need to be able to have those conversations too. The other thing that I would say, though, really quick, and this is not from President Nelson. This is my personal opinion. So Greg talks about, I'm assuming you're talking about Greg Mattson, Quick Show. I really like a lot of his stuff, and I would frame it a little bit differently, not because I disagree with him, but as a different perspective. I call it the paradox of civility. And the way that it works is if you are kind and thoughtful and patient, you're going to think and pray and consider your words carefully while everybody else is making a mess of it. There's an old story of two general authorities, and both of their wives had passed away, and they were both interested in the same secretary at church headquarters.
And this better be apocryphal, dude.
Oh, it's 100% apocryphal. Like, probably didn't even happen, right? And one of them, you know, was getting really excited. And he was like, yeah, I think I'm going to, you know, he told one of his buddies, I think I'm going to propose. And the next day, she's got a ring on her finger. And he goes, what the heck? So he goes to this other general authority and says, hey, I like, come on, man. Like, I prayed about it. I fasted about it. And you still, she still said yes to you. What happened? He said, well, you were fasting and praying. I was proposing. Right. Like, there's this.
You don't have to outrun the bear. You only have to outrun your friend. Right.
That's right. Exactly. There's something that we do where I think we spend so much time trying to get it perfect that we're not willing to say something at all. And so I really want to emphasize this point of like, hey, I'm not telling you to get on social media. It's bad for your mental health. I don't recommend it. But if you're going to do that, if you're going to speak up, choose the place that's good for you. I like Twitter. I like Facebook. Those are mine. Some people like Instagram. Fantastic. Do your thing. Don't worry so much about getting it perfectly right every time. Worry about saying true things as often as you can and trusting your friends and your audience to know when you do get it wrong. And I think people respond to that. I don't think I get it right all the time. Because when the best and smartest and kindest and most thoughtful people are the ones that are most hesitant to speak up, we are seeding the ground to the most extreme voices. And I don't think that that is good. I don't think that is right. I don't think that is. And also, I think we sit there and look at the world and go, oh my goodness, it's filled with crazies. It affects us. It affects our mental health. I think Sarah Coyne is a researcher at BYU who talks about social media, and she has a really good point. I really think that there is something to be said for the more active you are on social media, making posts, discussing with friends, whatever it is, you are better off than if you are just scrolling. I think that the doom scrolling is not super good for you. And I think it's because it's this distorted picture of reality. Instead of saying, no, actually, I am really happy. I love the gospel. I love the church. I'm good friends with people who don't, aren't in that place. And I'm not worried about it, right? Like, we get along just fine. So I think that's something that I would encourage people to do is like, there are a lot of us who are willing to bear testimony in sacrament meeting, because it's the right cultural venue. But it's also okay to stand up for what you know to be true in other places and other ways. And I think there's something really valuable about that. Even if it's just like, hey, I think we can disagree on presidential politics and still be friends. Like, that's actually a really controversial statement right now. And it's something that normal people can stand up and say and do a lot of good as they do, right? And I think that's important.
Yep. And President Nelson's pushing for exactly that. What's interesting in his wording in talking about that, he said, my dear brothers and sisters, this should not be talking about just the awful stuff that's going on. And we focus on social media because that's the loudest. That's the stuff that takes up a chunk of our day. But of course, that's only a symptom of what's going on in our hearts, right? He says, my brothers and sisters, this should not be. As disciples of Christ, we are to be examples of how to interact with others, especially when we have differences of opinion. Now, maybe it's a minor thing to pick the word. I think it's interesting. He said, especially and not even. He's not saying, oh, we should be nice even, and I know it's hard, guys, to go that extra mile, but even in this hard time, we should really grin and bear it. And, you know, when we have differences of opinion, still try to be nice. He said, no, especially that's when our discipleship just shows bright and clear.
And the other side of that is, you know, I feel like 20 years ago, I would have responded snarkily and been like, so you want me to be nicer when I already agree with people too? Like, what a silly thing to say. But literally, I have had conversations with people on Twitter where I'm like, you know, we agree, right? And they're like, yes, but we don't agree nearly as much as you think we do. I agree with you even more than you. Like, it's just so stupid, right? Like, this is just the nature of this
agreement fight.
Right, exactly. That's a good way to put it, right? I think that he is very serious about this. And by the way, as a teacher, looking at this from a pedagogical perspective, President Nelson pulls off something pretty impressive. It's actually very easy to make a rule that says, don't do this or this. It's also pretty easy to say, instead, I want you to do this thing up here that's really hard. This is the bar I want you to measure to. He gave a talk in which he totally destroyed this. You know, like I said, I'm big into civility. And one of the things people say is, oh, it's just a bunch of rules. It's just a bunch of rules that empower the powerful and all of that.
You mean like rules of discourse empower?
Yeah, exactly. So like, okay. Robert's Rules of Order and the Senate rules and parliamentary procedure and all of these just benefit the people in power, right? And the more you know about the rules, the more that you can get your way and blah, blah, blah. And And civility is just another way of doing that, right? And by the way, there is absolutely a strain of politics that has always tried to weaponize civility. And it's really dangerous, and you got to be aware of that. But what he has done in this talk is absolutely demolish the idea that civility is just jumping through a certain hoop, or that civility is nice to have, but not a big deal. This is something that is foundational to our identity as disciples of Christ. This is inspired by the fact that we attempt to follow the master who is a peacemaker. Like this is very, very deep to me. And he didn't just say, don't do this and don't do this. He said, here are 10 things not to do. Here are 10 things to try. And here's the goal that we're aiming for. And it's actually quite lofty. It's not be civil. It's be a peacemaker. Peacemakers needed is a really powerful type.
To your point, what I got out of there, out of his talk, and then also, again, we're going to be talking about Elder Suarez's talk, Elder Christofferson's talk later this season. They're all saying the same thing. It's not like, oh, you know, these are the rules of the boxing match and you have to play fair even if the other guy's playing dirty. Sorry, stinks to be you. Right? He's saying, no, these are your gloves. Like, these are tools that we are to use. And I'm not just asking you to be patient with people who disagree. I'm asking you to go out and change the world. And by the way, this isn't just like some pie in the sky, oh, you know, utopia vision that's never going to accomplish. He's saying we literally can change it. And he gives it a prophetic promise, which packs a punch. A prophetic promise that we can change the nature of discourse, change the nature of society if we change how we interact with it.
I fully agree. Let me add two very quick thoughts. I love what you said about tools. When people think of civility as a way to get around having the argument, it bothers me. And it doesn't bother me because they're wrong. There are too many times where it's used that way. Let me kick somebody out of a legislature because I don't like their views and I can call them extreme and radicals. And that way I'm winning the rhetorical fight without having to engage them on the real fight. The reality is that civility done right is the way to get to the hardest argument. It's the rules for the road that allow us to approach the hardest stuff, right? It allows us to get into really, really sensitive issues like what LGBTQ issues and trans bathrooms and stuff that is all over the culture wars and say, hey, but you know that I care about these kids. I know that you care about these kids. We're gonna come in from very different perspectives. Let's see where we can make some common ground here.
Well, when President Nelson's talking about it, like you said, it's not an optional thing. It is a tool that we use. I mean, that sets the bar really high. And when he says, as disciples of Christ, we're supposed to be this way, especially, I linked to Matthew chapter 5, verses 20, 46, and 47. Except your righteousness shall exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you shall in no case enter the kingdom of heaven. And then later he says, because if you love them which love you, what reward have you? Do not even the publicans the same? And if you salute your brethren only, what do you deem more than others? Not even publicans the same. So he's creating these groups that everyone understands to be this hated and authority and, you know, bad people. And then he's saying, look, it's not enough to just say, oh, well, I'm pretty good, you know, especially to people that agree with me. He's like, cool, well, welcome to, you know, normal life. I expect a much higher bar of my saints.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think it's funny. I sometimes talk to my students about, a lot of people will say, be therefore perfect. But you have to know what perfect means. It's not sinless. You can relax. It's not a big deal. And it's like, no. I hear you. It doesn't mean sinless. It means become whole or complete. And when you realize what your destiny is, that's a much scarier thing than just avoiding sin, right? Like, yeah. This is a higher bar, not a lower bar, right? This is really hard. When the prophet tells us we have an opportunity to change the world, I want to be really, really clear. First, I completely agree with him. I think we have that opportunity. I'm also reminded of when the Savior in the New Testament says, God is able of these stones to raise up children of Abraham. It is not us who are special. There's nothing about us. And if we decide to reject the prophet, if we decide not to listen to him, it's going to be really, really easy. It's not going to be hard at all for God to say, hey, if you're not going to listen, then I'm going to find another way to accomplish my work.
I'm able to do mine own work. Yeah.
That's right. This is not Latter-day Saint exceptionalism, right? This is not that kind of weird tribalism stuff. What this is anybody who decides to take up the work in the way of the master will find success and will do things the right way and will be prospered in their work. And by the way, there are a whole host of people out there that have nothing to do with our faith that are trying to do this, that recognize the same set of problems, who are saying, hey, contempt is an issue. Arthur Brooks is one of my favorites, right? Talks about the contempt issue in American politics. He's wonderful, right? Favorite line from him is, somebody asked him if he would run for president. He said, no, I don't think America's ready for a bald president. And I laughed and I laughed and I laughed and then I cried, right? Like, because I don't think he was joking, right? Like, he would be a phenomenal president. He's not going to run because he would lose. And it's because we don't pick our presidents based on their values or their policies. It's about whether they have hair.
And whether they can dunk on the other guy.
Right? That's 100% what it is, right? It's just so stupid and so shallow. There are a number of people out there who are having this conversation who also recognize that something is wrong. We do have a unique opportunity. We also have... That was invitation and also rebuke. We are being called to do something better and to live up to something higher. And it won't always be easy. But I don't think that's something where we should pat ourselves on the back, but we should be excited about what we could accomplish if we're really serious about it.
Yep. And speaking of that, when he talked about the possibilities of the changes we can make, I was remembering the sons of Mosiah, right? They went out with just such low expectations. Like maybe we can change one soul. Maybe we convert one person through the results of our ministry, right? They didn't have lofty ideals of converting, you know, seven cities or seven lands worth of Lamanites and altering the like warfare and history and course of the Book of Mormon forever. That wasn't their goal. And yet that's what they did. God's able to take these efforts, these humble efforts to get in there and just try and change a few hearts and try and soften a few hearts, especially, and then just blows it out. And we're not aware of the immense change that can come. The Lord told Mosiah, hey, your sons are going to have some amazing success. As far as we can tell from what the sons of Mosiah said, they never heard that promise uttered to them. Their expectations were far lower. And here's the prophet giving us the high bar right from the beginning, saying, you guys can be an immense force for good.
Well, and if we can get, so I wanted to read one little line here, or one paragraph here. Vulgarity, sure. Fault-finding, and evil-speaking of others are all too common. Too many pundits, politicians, entertainers, and other influencers throw insults constantly. I am greatly concerned that so many people seem to believe that it is completely acceptable to condemn, malign, and vilify anyone who does not agree with them. Many seem eager to damage another's reputation with pathetic and pithy barbs. So I have two thoughts on this. When I was young, I remember being taught, if a bad thought comes into your head, you know, hum your favorite hymn.
Sing out with vigor and vim.
Yes. Got it, right? And for some reason, I always had the impression that that applied specifically only to one kind of thought. And you know, that was the young men's talk, right? That we would have about, like, if you ever have a thought, hum your favorite hymn, right? I was in the car listening to talk radio when I was in high school, and I remember getting the distinct impression, I am angry right now. I am upset right now. I agree with what the speaker is saying, but I am angry. I shut it off. Now, That was a unique moment of, well, I mean, I was an old man when I was 18, right? Like, but I think genuinely there was some maturity in that decision that I wish more people would follow. If you are angry, you are more likely than not being taken advantage of. More importantly than that, though, it can be really hard when you feel outraged to not engage in that. So one of the things that I've started telling people about is, you know, I already told you about accusation and the epistemology of hell, nutpicking. So this is where you take the other group, the bad guys, and you take the worst examples of them. And this really bothers people when I bring it up. There are entire Twitter accounts who are dedicated to nothing other than, let me show you the worst of this group of people. And it sounds really gross until they're your political enemy. And then you go, well, no, I think that's justified. I think it's actually. And I think everybody has these, and we all follow these, and we engage in this stuff. There are entire news organizations that this is all that they do. I won't name names because that would be nutpicking. but like, vilification, and he says, condemn, malign, and vilify, vulgarity, fault-finding, and evil speaking. I don't think that it, how do I say this? President Oakes once was asked about sustaining church leaders, and he said, you can sustain church leaders. You can be wrong to criticize church leaders even when the criticism is right. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people got really upset about that, and I said, no, that totally makes sense to me. I totally get it, because you can put yourself in a spirit of fighting against them and wanting to critique them. It does things to you spiritually. Now we take that and we extend that to all of our brothers and sisters. And I'll give a specific example that this is one that I had to repent of a little bit. I love BYU. BYU is my alma mater. There's a lot of talk about BYU on Twitter these days and how it's going wrong and all of that stuff. I thought to myself, you know, those people running BYU are my brothers and sisters too. Maybe I need to cut them some grace. It doesn't mean that I don't speak out when I need to in the right ways and the right channels. I don't really love this new culture we're getting into where everybody takes to Twitter to air their grievances and to say, the real problem is these people and these people. Maybe that's not what I'm being called to do, and it's not doing as much good as I. And so that's one example that's been on my mind of like, maybe that's something I can do better.
Yeah. And I think there's a big difference between criticizing people and criticizing policies, right? I think it always goes back to, I love the idea of debating, arguing, discussing the ideas. It becomes another thing to take the BYU, for example, right? You can say, oh, I think that BYU is doing X and Y and Z wrong and these policies should be changed, whatever. It's another thing to say, well, so-and-so who leads such and such department is, you know, just whatever, and start name calling. That's where we cross a line between, hey, I'm trying to see if there's some better good that we can come of this. And again, to your point, through the proper channels is usually not through Twitter, versus another thing saying, well, look at who so-and-so is, you know, what so-and-so is doing. I think that's where we cross a line there.
There's another part where so in the next paragraph, he says, anger never persuades, hostility builds no one, contention never leads to inspired solutions. Regrettably, we sometimes see contentious behavior even within our own ranks. Now, all of that, I could give a whole talk on each one of those lines. He's so clear. Hostility, look, there. I don't know how to say this. Twitter is just filled with fighty people. All right. I asked one of my students, I said, are any of you all on Twitter? I feel like Twitter is old people. Like, Facebook is now for old people and Twitter is also for old people. I said, yeah, but Facebook is for old people that want to show pictures of their cats. Twitter is filled with like haters. Like, people are just grumpy all the time about everything. And I was like, wow, that's so on the nose. You have no idea how right that is. I don't think there's anything good about that. And by the way, I think the mental health research literature would agree with me. It's a really negative thing, but it's the next sentence that he says that like, really drove it home. We hear of those who belittle their spouses and children, of those who use angry outbursts to control others, and of those who punish family members with a silent treat. We hear of youth and children who bully, and of employees who defame their colleagues. I have a student who was just telling me about a really awful situation that they were in recently, and it was very much one of those where it's like, when students come into my office, I thought that it would be a lot of like, I don't have a testimony, what am I going to do? And a lot more of it is like, hey, so my mom's really mean to me. What do I do about that? Or my dad yells a lot all the time about anything. Like, it doesn't matter what I do. Like, that kills me a little bit, right? And I'm not a perfect parent. I'm not judging other people. Like, this is not about that. If the first thing that comes into your heart is that I'm attacking other people, look, I got my own stuff to work on. I'm trying the best I can too. Again, we have to give each other grace. But there's got to be a point at which we go, you know what? There is some of this happening in families and homes and in wards that should not be. And I think that's one that's one that hit hard and hit home for me.
I mean, and let's be honest, we've seen so much of that just the past 3-4 years, right? You ask any ward council in the church how COVID impacted their ward. It's not about, oh, well, we were shut down for a while or whatever, and then spring back in action. No, they're in every single ward across the United States, at least, there are people who are no longer back at church again. There are people who will no longer talk to each other again because of the divisions and the angst and the anger over this policy versus that policy has caused. What I worry is irreparable damage to the church membership itself at the local level.
To be clear, I don't think that COVID was, how do I say this the right way?
The symptom, not the cause.
I am not saying that COVID wasn't very serious. It was. I'm not saying that it wasn't really tricky politically. It was. I'm not saying any of that. I'm saying that if we had had COVID in other eras, we would have come through with a large measure of unity. And I think there was something about this time where we just weren't in that place. I remember my dad was an HR manager for a long time, and he happened to work at the church. And so he was allowed to do this. But he had a couple of people who were fighting and grumbling. And he said, you know, no one's in trouble. I'm not looking to fire anybody, but you have to sort this out. This is the kind of thing where unity is not optional. We have to be in this work in a way where we are together and we love each other and we see the best in each other. So you're going to both take 2 hours and you're going to go walk across the street. It was the church office building. You're going to go to the temple and you're going to spend some time there together. And then you're going to come back and report back to me. And I need to know that you're on the same page. Now, again, not everybody can do that. I feel like that's cheating, right? Like,
that's so cool, though.
But it's just like, we have to be at that level of unity. And by the way, I think Elder Christofferson said something really powerful on this. It's not that we just wave our hands and say, let's just be nicer. Like, that will not work. That is not what civility is. I don't think that that's what the prophet is asking us to do.
That's just saying, don't talk to each other.
That's right. That's right. The easiest way to do that is just to shut up.
Yeah. And then you get to content, right? Back to what Arthur Brooks was saying. That's worse than arguing.
Yeah. 100%. What I think Elder Christofferson exemplified so or illustrated so well with his story about B.H. Roberts is, at some point you have to bow to the authority of God. At some point, the unity does not come from us just, you know, elbowing each other and saying, hey, be nicer. It comes from us saying, listen, I'm going to come before the Lord on my knees and do whatever it takes for him to tell me what it is that I'm supposed to do. And I'm going to be humble enough to actually do that. And by the way, if you're doing that right, you're going to have something to learn every time you're in a disagreement with somebody, even if you're not the real cause of the issue. The Lord is going to give you that feedback, good and clear and very direct. And I think that's something that, what was it President Eyring said when Elder Bednar was president of BYU Idaho, there was a miscommunication or a disagreement, apparently, again, apocryphal. There was a miscommunication about budgets. And Elder Bednar said, no, I'm pretty sure that you promised this, not this. President Eyring said, no, I'm quite sure that I promised this and not that. And the next day, President Eyring woke up and he said, well, last night I got rebuked by the Lord. And by the way, if you haven't been rebuked lately, I highly recommend it. And he changed everything. But that's the spirit, right? Is that we aren't waiting for the other person to rebuke us. We're turning to the Lord and saying, what would you have us do?
I will bear personal testimony of that. After Roe v. Wade was overturned, I dashed off a quick Facebook post with a very short thought. The shorter, the more likely you are to make a mistake, by the way.
Yeah.
When I got online later that evening, I saw that blown up and I was getting attacked by people who I highly, highly respect. It's so, you're like, hey, you know, social media is not the real world. Well, you know, these are real people that I really love. And that was a very dark week for me. It was just a mess. But the revelation that I received, the correction that I got out of that, I wouldn't trade anything for that. I can kind of a little bit relate, and again, apologize to any of my friends that may be listening saying, wait a minute, I got angry at you. You're saying you wish you'd said that? I'm saying I would not trade anything for the revelation that I received and the correction I received. It's kind of like when, you know, Adam and Eve, they say, hey, we're grateful for our transgression, because if it were not for our transgression, we could have not known the joy of the saints and everything. When you go through one of these negative experiences, right, you end up with so much more than you started with. And God is able to take a bad situation and make it a blessing retroactively. It's so cool.
Well, and social media, I think you said before, is a graceless environment. And we need to fix that. And the way we fix that is by normal people making lots of rich, good mistakes. That doesn't mean cheap grace. I've really put my foot in my mouth sometimes. And when I do, I have to own it. And I have to say, hey, I really boogered that one up. Can I really apologize? I'm sorry, I didn't think through it. And that's also part of why I'm cautious online. It's that, you know, I'm not actually that worried about people digging up old screenshots of something I say. I'm pretty secure. I've got a good job. Like, I'm in a really lucky place. At this point, it's really just because I don't want to contribute to more noise and more anger and more frustration. And that's hard to do well. But I think with some practice, we can get it right. And I think that's what we're being called to do is there's a great talk called Instruments of the Lord's Peace, where I can't remember, Elder Wood, I believe it was. This is 10, 15 years ago now. He said, I was once invited on a cable news show where the producer looked at us and said, here, we would encourage you to speak before you think. and that's the very normal cable news thing to say. And I that's always reminded me, measure twice, cut once, right? Like the old construction saying, right? Like measure the wooden beam or whatever it is, measure it twice, make sure that it's right, and then cut once. And I'm not perfect at that either.
One of the revelatory pieces I got out of that social media experience was, I need to start praying when I'm about to post about something controversial. I need to pray and carefully consider the words, just as if I were like giving a sacrament meeting talk or something. I mean, it's not only in church that what we're saying starts to reflect back on the church, mm-hmm. and on Heavenly Father, mm-hmm. and on our Savior Jesus Christ. So we do definitely want to tread carefully. The brethren tread very carefully for that reason. It's not because they're afraid of offending people. It's not because they want to put on a good show. It's because they know that their words have the weight that really all of mm-hmm. ours kind of does.
And I think that's a really good summation of, you have to take risks. That's what I started with, is that, you know, the paradox of civility is that all the civil people keep quiet, and that causes a problem. But that means that you have to take risks in measured, thoughtful ways. And that's a hard balance to get right, right? The other thing that I would say is, I know people who have gotten it right and still been mobbed. And that's just the risk that you run. And there's something about that that I can't, you know, there's no way to guarantee that it will always be fair. And so if you're going to be involved, you have to recognize that's just part of life. That doesn't mean, in my mind, that you shouldn't speak out. You shouldn't say what you believe to be true. Maybe you do it carefully. Maybe you learn your lessons along the way. But I think 20 years from now, you're going to see a lot more people, a lot more chill about this. And a lot of it will be figured out. At least I hope it'll be figured out. But right now, the way that we get there is by normal people saying, you know, I actually think, that, you know, I have some real concerns about abortion. I think the Roe being overturned is going to be really controversial and cause some problems. But there's a big part of me that rejoices about that, too. And I know that's hard and this is tough stuff, but ultimately that is how I feel. And that's how I felt when it happened. So anyway, I think those are the kinds of conversations that can be had carefully, but still need to be had.
President Nelson is hitting hard. This is not optional. As disciples of Jesus Christ, we're to be examples of others. He even says, the Savior's message is clear. His true disciples build, lift, encourage, persuade, and inspire, no matter how difficult the situation. There's only one other time that I can remember President Nelson talking about in this very kind of polarizing side of way, saying, if you don't do this, you are not a true disciple. And that was in a devotional to young adults, where he was speaking of the Family Proclamation and the Living Christ and the Restoration Proclamation, kind of the three big proclamations of the church. And he said, those revealed words are what every true Latter-day Saint believes, and then encourages us to pray for witness. So he's drawing some lines here. He says, okay, if you want lines around discipleship, here they are. True disciples believe the doctrine. True disciples walk the walk as well. He goes on to say, make no mistake about it. Contention is evil. When I read that, I thought of a scripture in Mosiah 4 that also really hit home to me, where King Benjamin's talking about all the things that saints of Christ will naturally want to do when they experience this conversion, like the people of King Benjamin did. He says, you will not suffer your children that they will go hungry or naked. Neither will you suffer that they transgress the laws of God and fight and quarrel one with another and serve the devil who is the master of sins. Like, wow, that escalated real fast. I grew up in a house of four boys. We fought and quarreled all the time. And I never would have looked back and said, you know what we were doing? We were serving the devil in my home. But that's what that's what King Benjamin is saying. And it's not really hyperbole, right? If the author of the spirit of contention is Satan, there's only one person you're serving when you're being contentious. And then the last piece I'm going to connect to the Book of Mormon. He said, those who foster contention, President Nelson said, are taking a page out of Satan's playbook, whether they realize it or not. No man can serve two masters. We cannot support Satan with our verbal assault and then think that we can still serve God. Now, you and I were talking about earlier, I like to get into the realm of apologetics. I like to get out and defend the faith. And this is something that I kind of see in my community, and it's a little bit worrisome. And it reminds me of a scripture in Alma. So in Alma chapter 1, it's talking about, you know, there's these laws placed on the church to not persecute the non-believers. And then it says, but then there starts to be this contention, and they start contending warmly with their adversaries, even unto blows, and would smite one another with their fist. So he's talking about church members of the church getting aggressively out there to defend their faith. And then what is the ultimate result of that? In verse 24, the hearts of many were hardened and their names were blotted out and they were remembered no more among the people of God. And this is a great trial to those who stood fast in the faith that actually bore with patience the persecution which was heaped upon them. It's interesting. These defenders of the faith punch their way out of the church in defending the church. That tale has always been kind of a cautionary thing to me. It's like, yes, defend the gospel. President or Elder Holland, in his Costs and Blessings of Discipleship talk in 2014, he said, defend your faith with courtesy and compassion, but defend it. We're supposed to be out there. We're supposed to be on the front lines. But when we do so, we must make sure never to do it in the wrong way. Elder Holland also gave a great, I think it was a BYU devotional, and we'll link it in the show notes, where he talks about so much of the gospel is not saying no to Satan. When Satan asks us to do a good thing, but in the wrong circumstances, right? Change these stones into bread. The problem is not that Jesus shouldn't eat. The problem is self-serving in a time when he's supposed to be fasting, right? The problem of Jesus jumping out the temple is not because it's bad for him to actually get people to believe in him. He says what Jesus is effectively saying to Satan in all these instances is not no, it's yes, but not this way. How we accomplish God's work and the way that we go about it is so important. President Nelson says, my dear brothers and sisters, how we treat each other really matters.
I think that was the big takeaway that I had, is that the how matters. That One of the things that I love that President Nelson did was he gave a specific, clear example. And the example he gave was his two counselors, because these are people that we admire, we respect, and in some ways we probably think in our heads, no, they don't disagree. They agree on everything. I mean, they must, right? Like
it's like the perfect couple sitting on the pews at church. They must have, you know.
They've got it all figured out. They never have any disagreements. And he said, no, I need them to be clear. I need them to disagree, and I need them to bring up every possible aspect of something that I'm not understanding. And yet, despite that, I guess not despite that, but like the only way you can do that is if you have charity as the foundation. If you know that you care about each other, you respect each other. And that's one where I would say too, I think there are a lot of people that we argue with online and in other ways. And it's like, if the charity isn't there, if they're not, you know, if I don't know what good faith means, but if they're not really there for the right reasons, sometimes the best thing you can say is not today. I'm just not going to do it. If you're angry or frustrated or feeling contemptful, I'm not going to change that. I'm not going to convince you out of believing what you believe when your emotional core is so dead set against. And so, you know, in the Savior in the New Testament repeatedly is asked questions and he just gave unto them no answer. I think that there is such a thing as recognizing the wisdom and saying, I don't need to show up to every fight I'm invited to, much less to every fight I'm not invited to. Right? there are a lot of, you know, former members of the church who are on Twitter, and we get along fine. Because when they post something, I think, you know, I don't think they're actually asking for my opinion. Right? And I don't need to say what I think my opinion is. Now there are times when I'll private message them or something else when I feel like I can do some good. But I just don't think it's that hard to say, hey, I'm not that fighty. I'm good to just go along and get along. I think President Oakes and President Eyring probably know each other and love each other enough to be able to have some very direct disagreements in ways that benefit the president of the church.
Hal, I love you, but you're wrong.
Right, exactly. Exactly. You can hear it in President Oakes' voice, right? Now, here's the key. When this talk was first coming, I thought, oh no, people are going to say, they're going to wield this as a weapon to silence anybody.
I've seen some of that, yeah.
Right? Like, oh, you're being contentious. Don't you understand that President Nelson told us that we're going to weaponize this?
Or even trying to endorse things that are very counter-faithful, using this talk, saying, oh, right. This is bridge building. Well, okay, no, that's just a hit piece, sorry.
No, that's exactly right. And so I think, and again, this gets back to one of the things I've been feeling lately, which is I need to stand up a little bit more. I need to do it kindly. But I need to be able to say, hey, I know this is a spicy take, but I feel like somebody needs to say it, and I want to say my piece. So one of the things, though, that I loved was that he said, the way that we get around the contention issue is not avoid contention, it's embrace charity. Charity is the answer to this issue.
So it's not less dialogue, it's better dialogue.
That's right. And in fact, I think Arthur Brooks said, we don't need to disagree less, we need to disagree better, right? And I think that's exactly what we're talking about. Charity is the antidote to contention. Charity is the spiritual gift that helps us to cast off the natural man who is selfish, defensive, prideful, and jealous. Charity is the principal characteristic of a true follower of Jesus Christ. Charity defines peace.
That's perfect. Charity. And he never said the word niceness or any of the trite.
No. And by the way, I would absolutely argue that niceness is not Christ-likeness. Niceness is not kindness. And there is absolutely a problem with niceness sometimes in the church where the goal is don't ruffle feathers. The goal is don't say anything that'll make anybody upset. Look, the prophets made people upset. Nephi seems like he might have been a bit cantankerous, right? Some of these folks are disagreeable, and that is
I would say his younger brother Jacob was more cantankerous than he
was. I think that's fair, right? I think being disagreeable, I don't mean being disagreeable generally. Talking about the Big Five personality test, right? Disagreeableness has some virtues. And you need somebody who can say, yeah, I know I'm going to get pilloried for this, but I still got to say it. It's true. You know it's true. There is something about that that is really, really valuable. We can do a little bit more of that too.
Yep.
By the way, that leads us into peace at any price and walking on eggshells. One of the things that I have noticed of late is that the civility conversation has turned into, well, you weren't very nice because you said something I didn't.
Yeah, the tone police.
I think it is a very easy way to get around addressing the actual issue to talk about tone. And that is something that can be real. I don't think I do that often. But I have told people before, if you're not even trying on tone, then I don't think we're going to have a useful conversation. So you can either adjust your tone or I'm going to walk away. And that's that to me is totally fair. And not everybody likes that. The eggshells piece, I think, was really, really valuable. I am seeing an increasing trend towards, if you don't do it exactly the way that I want, then I'm gonna throw my hands up and stomp off. And I think that's really dangerous, right? Like, there's got to be a willingness to understand that other people are imperfect. We're going to have disagreements. We're not going to like how everybody does stuff, and we can still get along and we can still be friends. There are some people who have even turned this into a weird kind of conversational terrorism, where they're just waiting for you to say the thing. And once you do, then it's like, ah, see, told you, I knew you were hateful. I knew you were the worst. Yep. And there's nothing good about that. Right. And that's a real problem. And so I would really argue we can be better than that. I think no, not peace at any price, and no, not forcing other people to walk on eggshells. We can, resiliency in conversation can be really valuable. I'm reminded of Orrin Hatch and Ted Kennedy. Ted Kennedy gave one of his, you know, blistering speeches on the Senate floor, and then sat down next to to Senator Hatch and said, "Orrin, what'd you think? Wasn't that great?" You know, and they just kind of laughed about it. And it's like, well, when you've served together for 40 years or however long they were in the Senate together, you get to know each other pretty well, and you get to realize that some of it's, and by the way, less of it was grandstanding. You've got to get resilient to the fact that conversations can be hard, and that's okay, and you can do it anyway. And people will say terms that you disagree with, frame things in a way that you wouldn't, and it's fine. And you can still make headway, and you will be better for having had the conversation.
And one of the tools that he gives us to reach that point, and this is something that he's emphasized in the past two conferences, the temple can help us in our quest. There we are endowed with God's power, giving us the ability to overcome Satan, the instigator of all contention. Cast him out of your relationships. Now, see, I, as a guy who really likes just an energetic punch to the gut, that spoke to me. He's not saying, okay, guys, let's just be nice. Let's just, everyone be nice. Everyone calm down. He's saying, no, guess what? This is Satan's influence in your life, and cast him out. I'm like, okay, I can get behind nice, you know, call to arms like that. That's wonderful. Redirect to who the true enemy is. I wrote an article about this, that I read the story of Zeezrom in a completely different light. After Amulek and Zeezrom really go at it for a while, Alma stands up and he tells Zeezrom, hey, this whole plan you had has been completely foiled, but it wasn't your plan. It was the plan of your enemy, who is Satan. It's interesting. He never calls Korihor the enemy. In fact, he almost paints Korihor as a victim of the true enemy, Satan, and that's where he directs all of his fire for the rest of the conversation. And so I like to remember that when we have dialogues.
You were talking about niceness. I love President Nelson's line, "You will arise as a spiritually strong man or woman of Christ." This is not about this is not about weakness. This is not about being a pushover. This is not about any of those things. If anything, it takes more strength and more wisdom to respond deliberately and thoughtfully when something is bothering you or you disagree with something. I'm thinking right now about an event that happened a few months ago. A friend of mine works at the Deseret News, and Hal Boyd, and he wrote an article that I really liked, where he basically said, you know, members of the church sometimes think that the right thing to do is to let people say mean things about us, that we are turning the other cheek and being Christ-like. Except that what that actually does is it teaches us that not only is it okay for people to do that to us, but it's not a big deal if people do it to others. And here's the thing. I don't actually care that much if people make fun of members of the church at a football game, which is what it was about. I care a lot if that changes and turns into black people, or if it turns into disabled people. And when we stand up for ourselves, we kind of start to recognize, like, actually, there is a morally good thing to do. Like, it is morally requisite for me to say, actually, that's not okay. And I'm not okay with that. I'm not angry. I'm not vindictive. I'm not feeling like I'm being picked on super bad. Frankly, it was a football game. I don't think it was like, we hate Mormon people. Like, I think it was just something to say at a football game, right? Like, that's just kind of how it was. It's also something that we should say, no, that should be out of bounds. And a good disciple of Jesus Christ can stand up and say that and draw healthy boundaries. I think that's a really good way to see it.
Yeah, we're supposed to be defenders of the weak. Yeah. Another tool that we get, and this is something that I'm a little bit a nerd about. President Nelson finishes his talk with a prophetic priesthood blessing upon the membership of the church to be able to make the adjustments that we need. Now, what could you possibly ask more than to get a blessing from the prophet of God with his authority and his priesthood to enable you to make these changes? I'm just completely in awe of that. Every time he gives an apostolic blessing, I'm floored.
Well, and the opportunity, going back to what you said before, do I think that Latter-day Saints are somehow, you know, a cut above or anything like that? No. But do we have the opportunity to be? Yes. And are we being asked to be? Yes, we are.
And a unique injection of spiritual strength in this case.
I think absolutely. And I think, no, I think if we don't listen, it'll be to our detriment. But if we do listen, I think a lot about BYU Idaho. We're pretty insulated from a lot of crazy things that are happening in the world in a way that's really unique and special. And I think that's the kind of thing that's going to happen here, where we're going to look around and go, because we followed the prophet about being peacemakers, it protected us in ways we could scarcely have imagined at the time. And I feel pretty confident in that. But if we really try our best to be peacemakers, we will be better disciples of Jesus Christ. We will become closer to him, and we will work a lot more good in the world than we currently imagine that we could.
Amen. Can I say amen if we're not at church?
I think you're allowed to say amen. That's fair.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Conference Talk Podcast. This episode, we discussed President Russell M. Nelson's address, Peacemakers Needed. If you enjoyed this episode, give us a 5-star rating. You can find us on iTunes, Spotify, and anywhere you get podcasts. You can find links to all our podcast platforms on our website, conferencetalk.org. That's also where you can follow us on social media, drop us a comment, check out the show notes, find the resources we mentioned in this episode, and learn more about me, your host, Matthew Watkins. You can follow me on Twitter, @JoyfulRepenter. And big thanks to our guest, Benjamin Pacini, for joining me today. You can follow him @BenjaminPacini on Twitter. He also has some author profiles on the Public Square Magazine website, which if you have not checked that out, that is a fantastic resource for all things gospel. You can also find him at his podcast, Radical Civility, anywhere you get podcasts. But while we also appreciate new followers, it's better to follow the prophets and apostles themselves. Although we love speaking about the church and our leaders, we do not speak for them. Everything said on this podcast represents our own personal opinions. So join us next week for some more of those personal opinions on the Conference Talk Podcast.